figure didn't answer, only stood there with its narrow white hands dangling by its knees. And Jesse thought, its knees? Knees? Not possible, Jess. When a person's hands are hanging at his sides, they stop at the upper thighs. Ruth responded, her voice so hushed and fearful, Jesse almost didn't recognize it. A normal person's hands stop at the upper thighs. Isn't that what you mean? But do you think a normal person would creep into someone's house in the middle of the night, then just stand in the corner watching when he finds the lady of the manor chained to the bed? Just stand there, and nothing more? Then it did move, one leg. Or perhaps it was only the distracting motion of the shadows again, this time picked up by the lower quadrant of her vision. The combination of shadows and moonlight and wind lent a terrible ambiguity to this entire episode, and again Jessie found herself doubting the visitor's reality. The possibility that she was still sleeping occurred to her, that her dream of Will's birthday party had simply veered off in some strange new direction. But she didn't really believe it. She was awake, all right. Whether or not the leg actually did move, or even if there was a leg, Jessie's gaze was momentarily drawn downward. She thought she saw some black object sitting on the floor between the creature's feet. It was impossible to tell what it might be, because the bureau's shadow rendered that the darkest part of the room. But her mind suddenly returned to that afternoon, when she had been trying to persuade Gerald that she really meant what she was saying. The only sounds had been the wind, the banging door, the barking dog, the loon, and the thing sitting on the floor between her visitor's feet was a chainsaw. Jessie was instantly sure of this. Her visitor had been using it earlier, but not to cut firewood. It was people he had been cutting up, and the dog had run because it had smelled the approach of this madman, who had come up the lake path swinging his blood-spattered still saw in one gloved hand. "Stop it!" Goody shouted angrily. "Stop this foolishness right this minute and get a grip on yourself!" But she discovered she couldn't stop it, because this was no dream, and also because she had become increasingly sure that the figure standing in the corner, as silent as Frankenstein's monster before the lightning bolts, was real. But even if it was, it hadn't spent the afternoon turning people into pork chops with a chainsaw. Of course not. That was nothing but a movie-inspired variation of the simple, gruesome summer camp tales that seemed so funny when you were gathered around the fire, roasting marshmallows with the rest of the girls, and so awful later on, when you lay shivering in your sleeping bag, believing that each snapping twig signaled the approach of the Lakeview man, that legendary brain-blasted survivor of the Korean War. The thing standing in the corner wasn't the Lakeview man, and it wasn't a chainsaw murderer either. There was something on the floor. At least she was pretty sure there was, and Jessie supposed it could be a chainsaw. But it could also be a suitcase, a backpack, a salesman's sample case, or my imagination. Yes. Even though she was looking right at it, whatever it was, she knew she couldn't rule out the possibility of imagination. Yet in some perverse way, this only reinforced the idea that the creature itself was real, and it was becoming harder and harder to dismiss the feeling of malevolence which came crawling out of the tangle of black shadows and powdery moonlight like a constant low snarl. It hates me, she thought. Whatever it is, it hates me. It must. Why else would it just stand there and not help me? She looked back up at that half-seen face, at the eyes which seemed to glitter with such feverish avidity in their round black sockets, and she began to weep. Please, is there someone there? Her voice was humble, choked with tears. If there is, won't you please help me? Do you see these handcuffs? The keys are right there beside you on the top of the bureau. No movement. No response. It only stood there. If it was there at all, that was. Looking out at her from behind its feral mask of shadows. If you didn't want me to tell anyone I saw you, I wouldn't. She tried again. Her voice wavered, blurred, swooped, and slid. I sure wouldn't. And I'd be so... so grateful. It watched her. Only that and nothing more. Jessie felt the tears rolling slowly down her cheeks. You're scaring me, you know, she said. Won't you say something? Can't you talk? If you're really there, can't you please talk to me? A thin, terrible hysteria seized her then, and flew away with some valuable, irreplaceable part of her, caught firmly in its scrawny talons. She wept and pleaded with a fearful figure standing motionless in the corner of the bedroom. She remained conscious throughout, but sometimes wavered into that curious blank place reserved for those whose terror had become so great it approaches rapture. She would hear herself asking the figure in a hoarse, weepy voice to please let her out of the handcuffs, to please, oh please, oh please let her out of the handcuffs. And then she would drop back into that weird blank spot. She knew her mouth was still moving because she could feel it. She could also hear the sounds that were coming out of it. But while she was in the blank place, these sounds were not words, but only loose, blabbering torrents of sound. She could also hear the wind blowing and the dog barking, aware but not knowing, hearing but not understanding, losing everything in her horror of the half-seen shape, the awful visitor, the uninvited guest. She could not cease her contemplation of its narrow, misshapen head, its white cheeks, its slumped shoulders. But more and more it was the creature's hands to which her eyes were drawn. Those dangling, long-fingered hands that ended much further down on the legs than normal hands had any right to do. Some unknown length of time would pass in this blank fashion. 12:12:12, the clock on the dresser reported. No help there. And then she would come back a little, would start thinking thoughts instead of experiencing only an endless rush of incoherent images, would start hearing her lips speaking words instead of just babbling sounds. But she had moved on while she was in that blank space. Her words now had nothing to do with the handcuffs or the keys on the dresser. What she heard instead was the thin, screamy whisper of a woman reduced to begging for an answer. Any answer. What are you? She sobbed. A man? A devil? What in God's name are you? The wind gusted. The door banged. Before her, the figure's face seemed to change, seemed to wrinkle upward in a grin. There was something horribly familiar about that grin, and Jessie felt the core of her sanity, which had borne this assault with remarkable strength until now, at last begin to waver. Daddy, she whispered. Daddy, is that you? Don't be silly, the good wife cried. But Jessie could now feel even that sustaining voice wavering toward hysteria. Don't be a goose, Jessie. Your father has been dead since 1980. Instead of helping, it made things worse. Much worse. Tom Mayhoot had been interred in the family crypt in Falmouth, and that was less than 100 miles from here. Jessie's burning, terrified mind insisted upon showing her a hunched figure, its clothes and rotted shoes caked with blue-green mold, slinking across moon-drenched fields and hurrying through tracts of scruffy woods between suburban housing developments. She saw gravity working on the decayed muscles of its arms as it came, gradually stretching them until the hands were swinging beside the knees. It was her father. It was the man who delighted her with rides on his shoulders at 3, who had comforted her at the age of 6 when a capering circus clown frightened her into tears, who had told her bedtime stories until she was 8, old enough, he said, to read them on her own. Her father, who had cobbled together homemade filters on the afternoon of the eclipse and held her on his lap as the moment of totality approached. Her father, who had said, "Don't worry about anything. Don't worry. And don't look around." But she had thought maybe he was worried, because his voice had been all thick and shaky, hardly like his usual voice at all. In the corner, the thing's grin seemed to widen, and suddenly the room was filled with that smell, that flat smell that was half metallic and half organic, a smell that reminded her of oysters and cream, and how your hand smelled after you'd been clutching a fistful of pennies, and the way the air smelled just before a thunderstorm. "Daddy, is it you?" she asked the shadowy thing in the corner. And from somewhere came the distant cry of the loon. Jessie could feel the tears trickling slowly down her cheeks. And now something exceedingly odd was happening, something she never would have expected in 1,000 years. As she became increasingly sure that it was her father, that it was Tom Mayhoot standing in the corner, 12 years gone in death or not, her terror began to leave her. She had drawn her legs up, but now she let them slip back down and fall open. As she did, a fragment of her dream recurred. Daddy's little girl printed across her breasts in peppermint yum-yum lipstick. "All right. Go ahead," she told the shape. Her voice was a little hoarse, but otherwise steady. "It's why you came back, isn't it? So go ahead. How could I stop you anyway? Just promise you'll unlock me afterward. That you'll unlock me and let me go." The figure made no response of any kind. It only stood within its surreal jackstraws of moonlight and shadow, grinning at her. And as the seconds passed, 12, 12, 12, the clock of the dresser said, seeming to suggest that the whole idea of time passing was an illusion, that time had in fact frozen solid, Jessie began to think she had been right in the first place, that there was really no one in here with her at all. She had begun to feel like a weather vane, in the grip of those prankish, contradictory gusts of wind that sometimes blow just before a severe thunderstorm or a tornado. "Your father cannot come back from the dead," Goodwife Burlingame said in a voice that strove to be firm but failed miserably. Still, Jessie saluted her effort. Come hell or high water, the goodwife stayed right in there and kept pitching. "This isn't a horror movie or an episode of The Twilight Zone, Jess. This is real life." But another part of her, a part which was perhaps the home of those few voices inside which were the real UFOs, not just the wiretaps her subconscious had patched into her conscious mind at some point, insisted that there was a darker truth here, something that trailed from the heels of logic like an irrational and perhaps supernatural shadow. This voice insisted that things changed in the dark. Things especially changed in the dark, it said, when a person was alone. When that happened, the locks fell off the cage which held the imagination, and anything, any things, might be set free. "It can be your daddy," this essentially alien part of her whispered. And with a chill of fear, Jessie recognized it as the voice of madness and reason mingled together. "It can be. Never doubt it. People are almost always safe from ghosts and ghouls and the living dead in daylight. And they're usually safe from them at night, if they're with others. But when a person is alone in the dark, all bets are off. Men and women alone in the dark are like open doors, Jessie. And if they call out or scream for help, Who knows what dread things may answer? Who knows what some men and women have seen in the hour of their solitary deaths? Is it so hard to believe that some of them may have died of fear? No matter what the words on the death certificate say. I don't believe that, she said in a blurry, wavering voice. She spoke louder, striving for a firmness she didn't feel. You're not my father. I don't think you're anyone. I think you're only made of moonlight. As if in answer, the figure bent forward in a kind of mocking bow, and for one moment its face, a face which seemed too real to doubt, slipped out of the shadows. Jesse uttered a rusty shriek as the pallid rays falling through the skylight painted its features with tawdry carnival guilt. It wasn't her father. Compared with the evil and the lunacy she saw in the face of her visitor, she would have welcomed her father, even after 12 years in a cold coffin. Red-rimmed, hideously sparkling eyes regarded her from deep eye sockets wrapped in wrinkles. Thin lips twitched upward in a dry grin, revealing discolored molars and jagged canines which seemed almost as long as the stray dog's fangs. One of its white hands lifted the object she had half seen and half intuited sitting by its feet in the darkness. At first, she thought it had taken Gerald's briefcase from the room he used as a study down here. But when the creature lifted the box-shaped thing into the light, she saw it was a lot bigger than Gerald's briefcase, and much older. It looked like the sort of old-fashioned sample case traveling salesmen had once carried. Please, she whispered in a strengthless, wheezing little voice. Whatever you are, please don't hurt me. You don't have to let me go if you don't want to, that's all right. But please don't hurt me. Its grin grew, and she saw tiny twinkles far back in its mouth. Her visitor apparently had gold teeth, or gold fillings in there, just like Gerald. It seemed to laugh soundlessly, as if gratified by her terror. Then its long fingers were unsnapping the catches of its bag. I am dreaming, I think. Now it does feel like a dream. Oh, thank God it does. And holding it open to her. The case was full of bones and jewelry. She saw finger bones and rings and teeth and bracelets and ulnai and pendants. She saw a diamond big enough to choke a rhino, glittering milky trapezoids of moonlight from within the stiff, delicate curves of an infant's ribcage. She saw these things and wanted them to be a dream, yes, wanted them to be. But if it was, it was like no dream she'd ever had before. It was the situation, handcuffed to the bed while a half-seen maniac silently showed off his treasures, that was dreamlike. The feeling, however, the feeling was reality. There was no getting around it. The feeling was reality. The thing standing in the corner held the open case out for her inspection, one hand supporting the bottom. It plunged its other hand into the tangle of bones and jewelry and stirred it, producing a tenebrous click and rustle that sounded like dirt-clogged castanets. It stared at her as it did this, the somehow unformed features of its strange face wrinkled upward in amusement, its mouth gawping in that silent grin, its slumped shoulders rising and falling in strangled chuffs of laughter. No! Jesse screamed. But no sound came out. Suddenly she felt someone, most likely the goodwife, and boy had she ever underestimated the intestinal fortitude of that lady, running for the switches which governed the circuit breakers in her head. Goody had seen tendrils of smoke starting to seep out through the cracks in the closed doors of those panels, had understood what they meant, and was making a final, desperate effort to shut down the machinery before the motors overheated and the bearings froze. The grinning figure across the room reached deeper into the case and held out a handful of bones and gold to Jesse in the moonlight. There was an intolerably bright flash inside her head, and then the lights went out. She did not faint prettily, like the heroine in a florid stage play, but was snapped brutally backward, like a condemned murderer who has been strapped into the hot seat and has just gotten his first jolt of the juice. All the same, it was an end to the horror, and for the time being, that was enough. Jesse Burlingame went into the darkness without a murmur of protest. She struggled briefly back to consciousness some time later, aware of only two things. The moon had made it around to the west windows, and she was terribly afraid. Of what, she at first didn't know. Then it came to her. Daddy had been here, was perhaps here still. The creature hadn't looked like him, that was true, but that was only because Daddy had been wearing his eclipse face. Jessie struggled up, pushing with her feet so hard she shoved the coverlet down beneath her. She wasn't able to do much with her arms, however. The jittering pins and needles had stolen away while she'd been unconscious, and they had no more feeling than a couple of chair legs. She stared into the corner by the bureau with wide, moon-silvered eyes. The wind had died, and the shadows were, at least for the time being, still. There was nothing in the corner. Her dark visitor had gone. Maybe not, Jess. Maybe he's just changed location. Maybe he's hiding under the bed. How's that for a thought? If he is, he could reach up at any second and put one of his hands on your hip. The wind stirred, only a puff, not a gust, and the back door banged weakly. Those were the only sounds. The dog had fallen silent, and it was this more than anything else which convinced her that the stranger was gone. She had the house to herself. Jessie's gaze dropped to the large dark blob on the floor. Correction, she thought. There's Gerald. Can't forget about him. She put her head back and closed her eyes, aware of a steady low pulse in her throat, not wanting to wake up enough for that pulse to transform itself into what it really was, thirst. She didn't know if she could go from black unconsciousness to ordinary sleep or not, but she knew that was what she wanted, more than anything else, except perhaps for someone to drive down here and rescue her. She wanted to sleep. There was no one here, Jessie. You know that, don't you? It was absurdity of absurdities, Ruth's voice. Tough-talking Ruth, whose stated motto, cribbed from a Nancy Sinatra song, was, "One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you." Ruth, who had been reduced to a pile of quivering jelly by the shape in the moonlight. "Go ahead, Toots," Ruth said. "Make fun of me all you want. Maybe I even deserve it. But don't kid yourself. There was no one here. Your imagination put on a little slideshow, that's all. That's all there was to it." "You're wrong, Ruth," Goody responded calmly. "Someone was here, all right. And Jessie and I both know who it was. It didn't exactly look like Daddy. But that was only because he had his eclipse face on. The face wasn't the important part, though, or how tall he looked. He might have had on boots with special high heels, or maybe he was wearing shoes with lifts in them. For all I know, he could have been on stilts." "Stilts!" Ruth cried, amazed. "Oh, dear God, now I've heard everything. Never mind the fact that the man died before Reagan's Inauguration Day tux got back from the cleaners. Tom Mayhew was so clumsy, he should have had walking downstairs insurance." "Stilts? Oh, babe, you have got to be putting me on." "That part doesn't matter," Goody said with a kind of serene stubbornness. "It was him. I'd know that smell anywhere. That thick, blood-warm smell. Not the smell of oysters or pennies. Not even the smell of blood. The smell of..." The thought broke up and drifted away. Jesse slept. She ended up alone with her father at Sunset Trails on the afternoon of July 20th, 1963, for two reasons. One was a cover for the other. The cover was her claim that she was still a little frightened of Mrs. Gillette. Even though it had been at least 5 years, and probably closer to six, since the incident of the cookie and the slapped hand, the real reason was simple and uncomplicated. It was her daddy she wanted to be with during such a special, once-in-a-lifetime event. Her mother had suspected as much, and being moved around like a chess piece by her husband and her 10-year-old daughter hadn't pleased her, but by then the matter was practically a fait accompli. Jessie had gone to her daddy first. She was still 4 months away from her 11th birthday, but that didn't make her a fool. What Sally Mayhoot suspected was true. Jessie had launched a conscious, carefully thought-out campaign which would allow her to spend the day of the eclipse with her father. Much later, Jessie would think that this was yet another reason to keep her mouth shut about what happened on that day. There might be those, her mother, for instance, who would say that she had no right to complain, that she had in fact gotten about what she deserved. On the day before the eclipse, Jessie had found her father sitting on the deck outside his den and reading a paperback copy of Profiles in Courage, while his wife, son, and elder daughter laughed and swam in the lake below. He smiled at her when she took the seat next to him, and Jessie smiled back. She had brightened her mouth with lipstick for this interview, peppermint yum-yum, in fact, a birthday present from Maddie. Jessie hadn't liked it when she first tried it on. She thought it a baby shade, and that it tasted like Pepsodent. But Daddy had said he thought it was pretty, and that had transformed it into the most valuable of her few cosmetic resources, something to be treasured and used only on special occasions like this one. He listened carefully and respectfully as she spoke, but he made no particular attempt to disguise the glint of amused skepticism in his eyes. "Do you really mean to tell me you're still afraid of Adrian Gillette?" he asked when she had finished rehashing the oft-told tale of how Mrs. Gillette had slapped her hand when she had reached for the last cookie on the plate. "That must have been back in... I don't know, I was still working for Dunninger, so it must have been before 1959. And you're still spooked all these years later? How absolutely Freudian, my dear." "Well, you know, just a little." She widened her eyes, trying to communicate the idea that she was saying a little but meaning a lot. In truth, she didn't know if she was still scared of old poo-poo breath or not, but she did know she considered Mrs. Gillette a boring old blue-haired booger, and she had no intention of spending the only total eclipse of the sun she'd probably ever see in her company if she could possibly work things around so she could watch it with her daddy, whom she adored beyond the power of words to tell. She evaluated his skepticism and concluded with relief that it was friendly, perhaps even conspiratorial. She smiled and added, "But I also wanted to stay with you." He raised her hand to his mouth and kissed her fingers like a French masseur. He hadn't shaved that day. He often didn't when he was at camp, and the rough scrape of his whiskers sent a pleasurable shiver of goosebumps up her arms and back. "Comme tu es douce," he said. "Ma jolie, mademoiselle, je t'aime." She giggled, not understanding his clumsy French, but suddenly sure it was all going to work out just the way she had hoped it would. "It'd be fun," she said happily. "Just the two of us. I could make an early supper, and we could eat it right here on the deck." He grinned. "Eclipse burgers à deux?" She laughed, nodding and clapping her hands with delight. Then he had said something that struck her as a little odd even at the time, because he was not a man who cared much about clothes and fashions. "You could wear your pretty new sundress." "Sure, if you want," she said, although she had already made a mental note to ask her mother to try and exchange the sundress. It was pretty enough, if you weren't offended by red and yellow stripes almost bright enough to shout, that was. but it was also too small and too tight. Her mother had ordered it from Sears, going mostly by guess and by gosh, filling in a single size larger than that which had fit Jessie the year before. As it happened, she had grown a little faster than that in a number of ways. Still, if Daddy liked it, and if he would come over to her side of this eclipse business and help her push. He did come over to her side, and pushed like Hercules himself. He began that night, suggesting to his wife after dinner, and two or three mellowing glasses of vin rouge, that Jessie be excused from tomorrow's eclipse watch outing to the top of Mount Washington. Most of their summer neighbors were going. Just after Memorial Day, they begun having informal meetings on the subject of how and where to watch the upcoming solar phenomenon. To Jessie, these meetings had seemed like ordinary run-of-the-mill summer cocktail parties, and had even given themselves a name, the Dark Scores Sun Worshippers. The Sun Worshippers had rented one of the school district's minibuses for the occasion, and were planning to voyage to the top of New Hampshire's tallest mountain, equipped with box lunches, Polaroid sunglasses, specially constructed reflector boxes, specially filtered cameras, and champagne, of course. Lots and lots of champagne. To Jessie's mother and older sister, all this had seemed to be the very definition of frothy, sophisticated fun. To Jessie, it had seemed the essence of all that was boring, and that was before you added poo-poo breath into the equation. She had gone out on the deck after supper on the evening of the 19th, presumably to read 20 or 30 pages of Mr. C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet before the sun went down. Her actual purpose was a good deal less intellectual. She wanted to listen as her father made his, their pitch, and to silently root him on. She and Maddie had been aware for years that the combination living room-dining room of the summer house had peculiar acoustical qualities, probably caused by its high, steeply angled ceiling. Jessie had an idea that even Will knew about the way sound carried from in there to out here on the deck. Only their parents seemed unaware that the room might as well have been bugged, and that most of the important decisions they had made in that room as they sipped after-dinner cognac or cups of coffee were known, to their daughters at least, long before the marching orders were handed down from staff headquarters. Jessie noticed that she was holding the Lewis novel upside down, and made haste to rectify that situation before Maddie happened by and gave her a big, silent horse laugh. She felt a little guilty about what she was doing. It was a lot closer to eavesdropping than to rooting when you got right down to it, but not quite guilty enough to stop. And in fact, she considered herself still to be on the right side of a thin moral line. After all, it wasn't as if she were hiding in the closet or anything. She was sitting right out here in full view, bathed in the bright light of the westering sun. She was sitting out here with her book, and wondering if there were ever eclipses on Mars, and if there were Martians up there to watch them if there were. If her parents thought no one could hear what they were saying just because they were sitting at the table in there, was that her fault? Was she supposed to go in and tell them?
"I don't think so, my dear," Jessie whispered in her snottiest Elizabeth Taylor cat-on-a-hot-tin-roof voice, and then cupped her hands over a big, goofy grin. And she guessed she was also safe from her big sister's interference, at least for the time being. She could hear Maddie and Will below her in the rumpus room, squabbling good-naturedly over a game of cootie or parcheesi or something like that.